You are listening to a free version of the Majority Report with Sam Steeder. To support this show and get another 15 minutes of daily program, go to majority.fm, please.
The Majority Report with Sam Steeder.
It is Wednesday, August 11th, 2021. My name is Sam Steeder. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Carol Lenig, national investigative reporter at the Washington Post, co-author of I Alone Can Fix It, Donald Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. Meanwhile, Senate Democrats pass a $3.5 trillion budget resolution framework last night at some ungodly hour. Meanwhile, Senate Republicans block voting an election bill as Democrats refuse to press filibuster reform. In New York, Kathy Hochul preps the new New York governor. Dallas School District defies Republican Governor Abbott of Texas and announces it will issue a mask mandate. Meanwhile, the White House announces it will fund Florida schools who defy Governor DeSantis's mask mandate ban. In Afghanistan, the Taliban has now overrun three more provincial capitals as the entire Afghan government teeters on near collapse in anticipation of the U.S. withdrawal from that country. Severe heat from coast to coast, giving us a slight taste of our future with climate change. Texas hospitals fear they will be soon overwhelmed as COVID spikes causes a medical personnel shortage in Florida, Louisiana, and Arkansas. And lastly, the NSA Inspector General will investigate Tucker Carlson's claims of being spied upon. All this and more on today's Majority Report. Welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Thanks for joining us. Joining me, as always, Emma Vigeland. Hello, Emma.
Hello, Sam. How are you today?
Good. Good. You seem pretty happy.
I had espresso this morning.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Okay. I'm glad.
In addition to the coffee.
Well, all right, there you go. So things
watch
are going
to
get...
Watch out, world.
Watch out. We're really at it today. And we'll be talking to Carol Lenig soon. So last night, the Votorama, which could have lasted, I don't know, 48 hours or 24 hours, was actually rather short for a Votorama. This is where, in the context of a budget reconciliation, and where it is at this point is there is now a framework. It's going to be $3.5 trillion. It theoretically, I guess, could go down, but it has passed the threshold where Republicans would be able to stop it. It has not passed any threshold where Kristen Sinema or Joe Manchin could stop it or reshape it in some fashion.
Which is what they're hoping for.
Which is what the Republicans are
hoping for. They're leaking to Politico. GOP hopes that Manchin and Sinema whittle this down. I mean,
we'll talk in the second half of the show about the, you know, what the strategies are here. But like you say, the Republicans are hoping that it's going to whittle down. That is why McConnell, and you had what, 19 or 20 Republicans agree to the so-called bipartisan infrastructure bill, because by the standards that Joe Biden set, that bipartisan bill was pretty anemic. There's nothing particularly bad in it, although there are some who will say, and it's a good point, that Joe Biden's original proposal dealt not only with expenditures, but how these expenditures happen within the context of infrastructure spending that would have a structural impact on the power dynamics in our society. David Dayan has a great piece at the American Prospect talking about that issue in the context of broadband. Now, this stuff is a little bit titillating, so watch out. But the point being that Joe Biden's original proposal would have spent this money in a fashion that would have, A, probably provided more effective, wider broadband because it would have allowed for more competition rather than expending it in a way that ends up in the hands of the corporate behemoths who control essentially the broadband in this country. And what is problematic about that is twofold. One is that they do not have the financial incentive, once you give them that money, to distribute it and to deploy it in areas that really are the most desperate for internet connectivity, because that also, not uncoincidentally, is the least profitable for these companies to deploy. For a smaller company, it might be, this is their market, and it might be more, worthwhile for them to deploy. And then the other issue is how that impacts the power that these major corporations have in our society. So there are issues with the bipartisan infrastructure bill that go beyond it being anemic and being able to be supplemented by the reconciliation bill. But clearly, McConnell realized he had no way of, if he sank the bipartisan bill, it would enhance the ability of the Democrats to pass those things under a reconciliation bill and to do so in a way that was less to the liking of the Republicans. And by passing the bipartisan bill, they hope it will give Sinema and Manchin room to reject parts of the reconciliation bill. But I don't think we're going to see the whole thing sunk. Democrats will not pass in the House, at least House progressives have vowed to, they will not pass the bipartisan bill without the reconciliation bill.
And there's enough of them to do that.
There's more than enough of them to do.
And more than enough of, I mean, they already have the threshold for those who've committed publicly, but there are going to be other people that join with them for various reasons.
I would think so. And we also are in this weird situation where, you know, it would have been tougher, I think, to do with issues that they might have had with the COVID relief bill. But it's not like, I mean, it is sort of just shocking how little this $4 trillion potential expenditure is being, fronted essentially in our politics today. Here is Joe Biden at the White House press conference yesterday. I guess very jubilant about the bipartisan thing. There's something anachronistic about this because there is no political science that shows that voters reward this, particularly in an off-year election. There's just no political science that shows that there are, you know, maybe 20 years ago, there was like a swing vote contingent that was looking for this type of bipartisanship, but this stuff is never rewarded in and of itself. But here's Joe Biden. He's very excited about it.
It has the word bipartisan in it, so he gets a little giddy up in his step.
Let's watch.
After years and years of infrastructure week, we're on the cusp of an infrastructure decade that I truly believe will transform America.
I mean, the reconciliation has the ability to transform it. There's nothing transformative in the $500 billion of new spending on the infrastructure. It is, and frankly, the way that it's distributed is even less transformative.
Well, it's helpful to think about how it is distributed over time in like an infrastructure decade, because that makes the $1 trillion sort of price tag not look so actually imposing.
It's not that imposing, and it's also, you know, I mean, transformative would be where if the biggest number was not you know, necessarily the highways, but it was public transport,
right?
Or if the biggest number was the electric vehicles. Now, I understand the limitations of the bipartisan, but you know, let's not kid ourselves.
Is maintenance transformative?
Exactly.
Right.
It is transformative in that when you drive across a bridge, the percentage of chances of it crumbling are going to be less. I mean, I guess that's going to be nice, but I don't know from a... I don't know that I would call that transformative.
Like a coat of paint on a house doesn't transform the house.
Exactly. And, I mean... Yeah, I would. It's like even touch-ups don't.
Transform the house. Oh no, I want to get you down the woodworking.
Yeah, you don't want me to go down that road.
Yeah, jeez.
And the interesting thing about this again is there just doesn't seem to be any talking points for the Republicans here. So the Democrats certainly had, at least in the way that they envision politics, that play in a sort of a closed circuit in Washington D.C. They had an advantage that hopefully will be pressed in the reconciliation bill, but maybe they should have pressed it in the bipartisan bill, because even Mitch McConnell knew that if the bipartisan thing didn't pass, reconciliation becomes that much more formidable in terms of what could be done there. Here's Louisiana Senator John Kennedy on Hannity yesterday, and this is all they got.
I'm telling you, the Democrats desperately wanted this infrastructure bill. They wanted it like an axe wants a turkey. They wanted it like Ben wants J-Lo. And that's just a fact. And we just got outmaneuvered. Intelligence was chasing us, and we got beat. And
I really want to think about Ben wanting J-Lo.
It's like they were fighting for a rebound.
Yeah, I mean, this is
a couple wants another member of that couple.
This is a guy who's announcing, I'm worried about Donald Trump and I'm worried about primary. I mean, that's basically it.
Yeah.
But so, here is our friend
trying to get that kid vote by
exactly
bringing out all the pop culture references. Did you know that Ben and J-Lo are back together, Sam?
No, I had no idea.
I think we talked about it already. But
I was going to bring up, like, wait, is
your
that...
Your eyes glazed.
We told you, Sam.
Oh,
right.
All right.
We did tell you, but you just, it's like...
I'm keeping track of a lot of Hollywood couples, so it's hard for me to keep them straight.
I'm still in denial about it.
Here is our friends at Fox and Friends. And, this is the problem that they have. Is like, what are they going to argue against in this bill? Here is Brian Kilmeade, Steve Doocy, and Ainsley Earhart.
This isn't a crisis. This isn't 2008 where the bottom fell out of the economy and people are trying to find out how to sustain it. This isn't the beginning of the pandemic when the entire economy shut down. You're looking at a country that spent an incredible amount of money in the middle of a pandemic that China caused. Now we're in the back end of that. The unemployment rate is in the mid fives. The GDP grew at a staggering rate. You can't take a bow, President Biden, on one hand, and then say it's an emergency to restructure the country on the other. Now, who's going to be the Republican that comes in next and says, I'm going to get rid of pre-K. I'm going to get rid of elder care. I'm going to get rid of school lunches. I'm going to get rid of free junior college or community college. It's politically toxic to do stuff like that. Take it away once it's given. That's the hope. Bernie Sanders was a backbencher who couldn't comb his hair that people ignored in the lunchroom. Now he is driving the agenda for the country. Nobody elected him president. Even the Democrats rejected it. But somehow Joe Biden took his agenda and thinks we want it.
Well, wait, so close.
They're so close here.
But why would it be politically toxic
if nobody wants it?
But then people want it.
That's sort of the conundrum he has there.
AKA nothing going on.
Now, first off, we should say, again, reminder, Joe Biden's proposal was a $5 trillion package. in two tranches. You know, one of like 2.2 and one of $2.3 trillion. So, in fact, this is also Joe Biden's perspective. Bernie Sanders wanted $6 trillion. But Kilmeade's right there. He understands it. What the dilemma here is, like, we cannot give people the material benefit they want, because if we do, we can't take it away.
Well, that's part of, like, their struggles with how to approach Biden specifically, right? They first did the, oh, he's cognitively declining thing, but now they're kind of landing on he's beholden to AOC and Bernie and the crazy socialists.
Well, they've been doing that for
a
long time. Like,
no,
he's
I know,
puppet.
But nothing's sticking. This is why critical race theory is the new thing to cling on to, because they just, like, they don't have scary black men in office. But then they have to, at the in the same breath, say that if he's beholden to the socialists, right, and he's passing their agenda that's so popular that if you took it away it's politically toxic, then dude, I've got news for you. Socialism's kind of popular.
Nobody wants it, but we can't take it away because everybody wants it.
Yep.
Bernie's mysterious methods.
Yes, indeed.
And he doesn't have a comb.
Well, that's why he spends his time plotting instead of combing.
Being with other senators at the lunch table. By the way, I thought they liked outsiders. And all of a sudden, him not being buddy-buddy with, you know, Rand Paul is a real issue for them.
We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, Carol Lenig, national investigative reporter at The Washington Post, co-author of I Alone Can Fix It, Donald Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. Got a couple of sponsors of the program today. Emma's favorite. Of course, it's the Hello Tushy Bidet. Look, you lost your right to get in any way.
But that was an
accident. Yeah, I know. That was an accident. All right. But as you know, summer's here. The living ain't easy if you're getting all sweaty. Not in your butt, essentially.
Say swamp ass.
Swamp ass. How do you stay on top of this? Well, try a refreshing spray from a Hello Tushy bidet. Yes, the Hello Tushy 3.0 modern bidet attachment is here. And folks, if you've ever been bidet curious, this is your opportunity. It's stylish. It is eco-friendly. It is super easy to install. And it saves you money. Hello Tushy 3.0 doesn't just clean your butt with a precise stream of fresh water. It cleans itself. The Smart Spray Automatic Nozzle. It is super easy to install, folks. It attaches to your existing toilet. You don't need any electricity. You don't need any extra plumbing. It cuts your toilet paper use by 80%. It pays for itself within a few months. It is incredibly reasonable, you know, relative to an installed full-on bidet. And it has you covered with a 60-day risk-free guarantee and a 12-month warranty. If you've already got a Hello Tushy on your pot, treat yourself and your butt to a new 3.0 model. And if you're new to the revolution, know that you're joining millions of happy Hello Tushy customers. I went bidet over COVID, never looked back. It's my own pun.
Never looked bidack.
Well, yeah. Never looked backside. Honestly, folks, if you've ever honestly contemplated the idea of a bidet, now is your opportunity. You can defeat swamp ass. Go to HelloTushy.com/majority. Get 10% off plus free shipping. It's a special offer for our listeners at HelloTushy.com/majority for 10% off. HelloTushy.com/majority. And our other sponsor of the day, one of my favorite design companies that help you increase your dental hygiene. When I go to the dentist now, I get very, very good looks from them. They're impressed. Wow. Why? Because I have a full array of Quip products. I've got the toothbrush. I've got the flosser, the refillable flosser, which I can't stop talking about. Honestly, Mile and I have actually sat there and checked this thing out. Talked about our flosser. They also now have mouthwash. Mouthwash has not changed in 140 years. Most brands are still selling those big, bulky bottles that are full of mostly of water and alcohol. That's why the oral care experts at Quip created a mouthwash that gives you more of the ingredients you need, and it comes in an eco-friendly refill bottle that is 100% recyclable. Like I say, you know, Quip is the makers of the electric toothbrush, the floss that I talk about a lot, also the gum with the sort of Pez dispenser. Well, Quip mouthwash kills bad breath germs, helps prevent cavities, leaves you feeling fresh thanks to a formula that gives your mouth everything it needs. It has four times concentrate, has fluoride, xylitol, and CPC, but they left out the artificial colors and the stinging alcohol you find in a lot of other rinses. And you get a you can get a customizable subscription. You'll get refills automatically delivered straight to your door every 3 months. I've fully automated my life at this point almost. I don't have to think about anything. I don't want to spend time like, oh, I got to go out and get a new toothbrush. It is perfect for me. Quip's refill bottles are made from 100% recyclable plastic. Mouthwash has the perfect finishing touch to the complete oral care routine that you have with Quip. You pair it with a Quip electric toothbrush, both for kids and adults. Saul loves his, gives him the 2 minutes. He knows when he's done. Refillable flossers, and the Quip's a great tasting, good for you gum. It can keep your teeth clean between brushings. Check it out, folks. And if you go to getquip.com/majority5, it's the majority, word majority, and number five, right now, you can get $5 off a mouthwash starter kit. That's $5 off a mouthwash starter kit, which includes a refillable dispenser and a 90-day dose supply of Quip's four times concentrated formula at getquip.com/majority5. Spelled getquip.com/majority5. Quip, the good habits company. All right. I want to welcome to the program Carol Lennig, national investigative reporter at the Washington Post, co-author of I Alone Can Fix It, Donald Trump's Catastrophic Final Year, which, of course, she co-wrote with Philip Rucker of the Washington Post. Carol, do we have you?
You do have me.
We can't see you, but we can hear you.
I think there are small technical difficulties, but I'll try to make my voice make up for it.
Okay, fair enough. Appreciate you joining us. So and I'm here with Emma Vigeland.
Hi, Carol.
If you can see. So let's just start with this. What really struck me was you and Philip Rucker wrote A Very Stable Genius, which covered basically the first 3 years of Donald Trump's presidency. Why did he cooperate with you for this one?
It was pretty much a cinch to get a sit down with Donald Trump, the former president. We did all our reporting before we went down to see him and before we really actively sought his input. But we wanted to hear his view and we wanted to fact check some information with him. And what we were surprised by was how quickly he and his aides basically said, sure, come on down. I found it interesting because, you may know, and I think some of your viewers and listeners may know, that he called us, a lot of interesting names when our first book came out, Stone Cold Losers, Third Rate Reporters. Losers was his favorite. So it struck me that, what is true in his presidency was true after his presidency. He really craves an audience. And especially now that he doesn't have Twitter or, all of these opportunities to interface with reporters every day on the South Lawn.
Well, so what was that like? What was it like going down to talk to him after all of these things were said? What was his kind of demeanor and outlook towards you guys? I mean, was he just craving an outlet to speak, or did he take in the opportunity to throw some haymakers?
Haymakers, nice.
I don't know if he's capable of that, but...
What I found really fascinating about the visit was just the theatrics of it. It became clear to Phil and to me that we'd been invited at a specific time to a specific place for the drama of what was unfolding. One, We were asked to come to the lobby of Mar-a-Lago at 5 o'clock. It happens to be the place where everyone traipses through for dinner, the club members, as they enter to get ready for, you know, the raw bar. And so they were getting to see that the president, the former president, still has all sorts of national reporters and others traipsing down to Florida to hear him, to get an audience. And meanwhile, we were allowed to see all of the people sort of bowing and scraping as they entered to, you know, throw their hellos to him, and all sorts of individuals obsequiously walking over to him to tell him how great he is. So it was a little bit of theater on both ends of the scale.
I'm trying to hold off on this question, but like, I mean, the guy's a lunatic, right? I mean, that's like the level of psychological desperation involved in trying to prove to the members of your golf club that you are still relevant as an ex-president. Like, that just seems like an insatiable, bottomless pit of self-esteem issues, right? Like, you're an ex-president. What do you need to parade the fact that someone wants to interview you for?
I like that line, you're an ex-president, right? Because as an ex-president, you're in a special club. I mean, there just aren't very many members, and it's such a rarefied world. It should give you a lot of confidence, so to speak. I'm not a mental health professional, and neither is Phil. We don't pretend that we know what's going on exactly in the mind of Donald Trump. But what we do know from watching him is just patently obvious. He needs and breathes media attention. That oxygen is critical to his survival. And because he doesn't have a platform anymore, we were another opportunity for him to, as he said, get the word out. You know, he's living in this alternate reality where the January 6th was a bunch of loving, warm, hugging individuals who were ushered into the Capitol by welcoming Capitol police officers. In his alternate reality, as he relayed to us, you know, there were many, many, many thousands of ways that the election was rigged to deny him his rightful second term. And, you know, Black Lives Matter protesters were evil threats to our country. All of these things are baseless, but those are that's the reality he's living in now in his club.
Do you think, and you know, when he expresses those three assertions as an ex-president, and I want to get into sort of, you know, obviously the TikTok, you know, as we go through COVID and Black Lives Matter and then the campaign. But when he makes those assertions, right, and there's three distinct ones there, that January 6th rioters were loving people and they were just ushered in by the police, and Black Lives Matter was an existential threat to the country. And that he won the election. I mean, those last two, it's not hard for me to imagine that he actually believes. But was your sense that he genuinely believes these things, or either way, did you see any disparity between what you perceived as his sincerity about the beliefs about those three things?
So in my line of work, I'm not a police detective, but one of the skill sets that I think that I can call upon is the ability to tell when people are BSing me, misleading me. People give off a lot of body language that indicates that. And what's fascinating about Donald Trump is we know from our reporting for this book that he knew he lost. You know, he confided to Kellyanne Conway the day after, you know, I'm so depressed. I don't know how we lost to Biden, but, I guess we did. So we know he knew that then. His hardened inner narrative when we visited with him in March was that he absolutely won. And I'm telling you, his body language in that interview shows no deception. Either he is an amazing, skillful liar, or he has convinced himself of this in the intervening months. He shows no typical signs of deception.
Okay, and so, all right, so let's talk. I mean, what fascinates me about this story is really sort of the people around him, and because as far as I can tell through your reporting, there was a lot of people who basically functioned as a check on the worst of his worst impulses to the extent that they could, right? I mean, there's a lot of like, people are quiet around him, but they're panicking inside on some level. I mean, let's talk about COVID. Like, what did he just simply decide at one point? Like, was he under the belief that this was just not real enough that he could just sort of plow through it? Or was it just a belief that like nothing's real enough that you can't just plow through it?
I love this question, Sam, because it gets right to the heart of a theme that's just true about Donald Trump. He had a particular way of governing and leading that really didn't have to do with governing and leading. He was fixated on winning the, you know, hourly or daily news cycle. It was all about the impression, the optics. It was all about what he could sell, essentially, kind of like the real estate developer. Can I convince people that these condos are really the height of luxury and that most of them have already been purchased and you better get in now before they're all gone? I mean, his optics game is really good. But unfortunately, that toolkit, that skill set was not just woefully inadequate, it was a disaster when he applied it to a real crisis. In fact, in our first book, A Very Stable Genius, we talked with sources who essentially foreshadowed this. They warned us, you know, we're so lucky that Donald Trump hasn't been hit and this country hasn't been hit with a real crisis. As for his belief, your central question about the belief, he believed everything could be managed as a PR event. And unfortunately, what people needed in a public health crisis, a lethal virus marching over the globe from China to Europe to the United States, not exactly always that way, but overwhelmingly that way, what they really needed was clear, straight information, not happy talk. They needed to know how to protect themselves. That's not what Donald Trump wanted to give them. Donald Trump wanted to convince them, the economy's great. Shut Nancy Messonnier up, the CDC official who's warning people that our lives are going to change. Get her away from the microphone. We need to tell everybody everything's going to be fine. Well, that's not how you protect American lives. And unfortunately, we found that out.
And what's interesting, too, is just that if this had been approached in a way where facts were given, there's evidence that the American people would have responded to that. I mean, I believe that there wouldn't be this PR backlash that he anticipated, but it's like, it's almost as if he knows nothing else, and his mind doesn't really move past that. Like, I mean, I know you kind of answered that earlier by saying that that's how he sees the world, but is that an accurate characterization? Because, you know, was there ever a glimpse or a thought of doing something differently? Because I think the frustration with him when there were so many unknowns, and that's why someone like Andrew Cuomo got a ton of free media, was that there was just nobody giving facts.
Yes, there was nobody giving facts or no one authorized to give facts. And Emma, I think the point's a good one. Like, he could have won re-election in the view of many of the people around him if he had just sort of owned the virus in the sense of, okay, look, this thing happened to us and I'm your leader and your savior and your protector. And here's what we all need to do. Bill Barr, we learned for the reporting for our book, came to the president in April, and he was pretty adamant and warning the president privately, Mr. Trump, Mr. President, you are going to lose this election if you keep up with this chaotic infighting and impulsive news conferences, these weird circusy shows, this place where you talk about injecting bleach in the body as a possible solution, and where you dispute what your health advisors said the other day. This stuff's making voters anxious. And even people who really support you and what you do, that group is going to start to peel away from you. And actually, Bill Barr was right.
But I mean, was he that right? And I guess this is a question more about the American public. I mean, Donald Trump, 40,000, I think 40, maybe 50,000 votes switching the other way in three states. What is it? Arizona, Wisconsin, and Georgia. He would have tied, I think, in the Electoral College. I can't remember the numbers off the top of my head. But I mean, for a guy who was saying inject bleach into your body, and I want credit for that idea just in case it actually works. That's a pretty close election.
If memory serves, and I apologize, I think it might be 74 million voted for Trump, 80 million or about for Biden. So it wasn't that close, but you're right about certain swing states. I don't dispute that at all. I think what Barr was getting at is there's going to be a group within your sort of ardent supporters that are going to get tired of this and get worried about this. And he was right about that. But there's no question, there is a core group of people that Donald Trump masterfully tapped into who feel angry, who feel fearful, angry that the country's going in a direction they don't like, worried about the diversity of this country in a strange way, fearful of how the economic winds are not blowing their way. They may be in some instances, Trump supporters are the first generation in these forgotten, rural communities that are going to see their children not do better than them. So he has tapped into that community and dubbed himself their savior. And so many of them still to this day believe it.
Sure. All right. Let's talk about the challenges. I mean, I think you and Philip interviewed over 140 different people over the course of this. Maybe I can't.
That's right. That's right.
And to what extent? There's a lot of people who enter into this administration. And certainly when you're talking about the last year of the administration, right, they've seen the implications of that for some of the people, right? Sean Spicer's on Dancing with the Stars and now he's on OWN. I mean, congratulations. But there's it could for some people have an impact on their careers. To what extent did you feel? To what extent could you, how did you approach the dilemma that a lot of these people, particularly as you get further into 2020 and the president is saying, inject yourself with bleach or something to that effect during a pandemic, are trying to, they're involved in a reformation project for themselves, that...
Yeah, I get your question. It's a good one. And you know why I like it, Sam, is I think more and more it's incumbent on reporters like myself and Phil to sort of show our work like a math class. Like we want to explain to people how we do it in the era of fake news and how successful Donald Trump was in promoting that idea that reporters are making stuff up. Oh, I wish, if it were so easy, it would be a lot easier to be a reporter if we made stuff up. But no, we actually corroborate everything. There are many things we don't publish because we're so careful. Even though we think they are true, we have to meet a very high standard. I feel as though what's really important is to show our work. And in this instance, many people spoke to us on background because they were afraid of the pain and vindication that Trump could bring down on their heads if they spoke out against him publicly. That will change over time, I'm sure. But we were on guard for folks trying to rewrite history in a way that was more favorable to them. We were on guard for people who were trying to burnish a slightly damaged reputation and tell a story in which they were braver or stronger or more more of an obstacle to Donald Trump's dangerous ideas than they actually were. And what we found was when we went to corroborate some of the claims with people who weren't fans of those individuals, their stories stood up. And the ones that didn't, we didn't publish. You know, we had to test these with documents, with independent, objective witnesses, and that was important to us.
When one of the things that you talk about was Lafayette Park, right? And I guess you also reported in the book that Trump really wanted to bring out the military for Black Lives Matter protesters, and was more or less dissuaded from that. But let's talk about the Lafayette Park, because there was a new, you know, the Inspector General report came out, I guess, a month and a half ago, maybe 2 months ago. How did that line up for you? Like, the Inspector General report says now that they weren't clearing it for the sake of Donald Trump, but they were clearing it because they needed to put up fencing, which also just seems bizarre to me. Like, maybe you want to do that at night when nobody's there, as opposed to having to bring in a personnel. Like, what's your sense of what happened there?
I'm with you. I mean, I think that I reported this in real time. I reported on this shortly after the fact, and I reported it again for the book. And each time I learned something new, and it did not dissuade me from my earliest instinct, which is the Secret Service, something I know fairly well, is never going to cross that square with a group of protesters gathered there and take the president across it unless that park is entirely cleared. And there was no reason to clear the park urgently other than the president's decision that afternoon and his coordination with his White House chief of staff and his Secret Service team to go across the square for a photo op. Remember, that Monday morning, June 1, began with the president livid. I mean, trying to rip the skin off people's faces. He was so angry, meeting with his chief of staff, his chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Mark Milley, his chief of staff, forgive me, I'm going to blank, Mark Meadows, his defense secretary, Mark Esper. He's meeting with them. And why is he angry? He's angry that it's been reported that he had to be taken to the bunker a couple of nights before. He's not mad that he was taken to the bunker. He's mad that it looks weak, that he had to hide from the protesters, the Black Lives Matter. He says to them, well, what are foreign leaders thinking? I can't even control my own capital, my own White House. I must look weak to them. He wants this fixed. And his solution that he devises with his daughter, Ivanka Trump, that afternoon is, instead of bringing 10,000 military troops to the square, he's going to walk across Lafayette Square and hold up a Bible to show that he's got control over this city. He's able to walk out the front door. Sorry, that's a long-winded answer to your question. But that report, by the way, that you mentioned, I'm sorry, that's a completely incomplete picture of what happened. The inspector general in that case, appointed by Donald Trump, did not interview the key people at the White House or anyone at the Secret Service. So how can it answer the question of what the purpose was if you don't talk to the two people who were planning the only urgent reason to clear the square that afternoon?
I mean, I'm with you. I mean, it just sounds like just a bizarre decision. Like, we need to do this right now. Coincidentally, after we do it, the president has decided, that's clear. Like, we need to put this fencing up right now when there's thousands of people there. It just doesn't make any sense whatsoever.
It's not only rationally dubious. The facts indicate that, I mean, the reporting we did for the book indicates that the real order came from the White House.
And I think at first, I think it was Barr had claimed, if I remember correctly in the sequence, that Barr had said that it was his decision, that he walked out there and said, we're going to go across. The whole thing sounded dubious, but it also, I find disturbing the idea that, like, the inspector general which is supposed to be sort of function as close to an ombudsperson as we can get in the context, in this context, is that highly politicized, right? Like, I mean, like they're supposed to be independent.
Yeah, and I'm wary of reaching a conclusion without facts that the inspector general is politicized. I'm just mentioning a fact, which is that he was appointed by Trump. He insisted at the time of the report that politics and Trump's appointment have nothing to do with the way he sculpted the report. But as a reporter, a journalist, a researcher that tries to gain the exact same information, I really wouldn't have a complete story if I didn't talk to the people who were arranging for the reason to clear the report. Clear the square.
I hear you. I will I will make that conclusion since I don't have those bona fides.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let me ask you about this. Like, what did you notice? I mean, because one of the things that again for me with a story like this for Donald Trump is the people around him, right? Like, 20 years ago, if everything was the same, you would not have, however, 100+ Congress people and half a dozen senators vote to decertify the election on January 6th. But the Republican Party has changed, and there may have been people in the White House a year ago who were trying to put the brakes on what Trump was doing. Don't bring out the military to deal with Black Lives Matter. You know, Milley, your reporting suggests that he thought there was, you know, at the very least, some attempt at a, you know, I guess a coup, for lack of a better word. It's conceivable to me that 10 years from now, when Marjorie Taylor Greene is president, the people who surround her will have also, you know, evolved or devolved, however your perspective is on that, and they won't be tapping the brakes. Did you see a difference between the sort of, and there were a lot of people who came through the White House in the first 3 years, as well, I guess, ultimately in the fourth, but did you, like, was there a difference in the sets of administrative personnel that, had some people been there in the last year versus the first years, or vice versa, that maybe the outcomes of these situations would have been different?
You know, I also love that question because it goes right to the theme that connects the two books, you know, Stable Genius, our first book, our first attempt to understand the Trump presidency, and then I Alone Can Fix It, you know, that final devastating and chaotic year. The first sort of chunk of the Trump presidency, those first 2.5 to 3 years, the president had some pretty serious people around him. I mean, not an A++ team in every regard, because there were a lot of people pretty anxious in the Republican Party about signing on with Donald Trump based on watching his campaign. So he didn't have like a lot of Bush appointees going, oh yeah, I want to help this guy out. But you had some significant serious adults, people like Rex Tillerson, Secretary of State, you know, bad reviews for being a Secretary of State from employees who felt he was a little aloof, but a really serious guy who ran a Fortune 100 company. General Mattis, you know, Mad Dog Mattis, a guy with a real student of history, a ton of experience in the field and also in management. You had John Kelly, a general who had spent so much time in Southcom, understood the border, understood Congress as a previous job that he had interacting with Congress and the Defense Department. So these were serious people. He fired all of them. He fired almost everyone in the first zone. He changed and went through so many chiefs of staff and defense secretaries and homeland security secretaries. It was hard to keep track as a reporter at times. And what he was able to do was grind through all those people who were holding him back. He had fewer people in the final year holding him back and giving him advice. But worse than that, he'd become emboldened. He had realized he emerged unscathed from the Mueller report. He'd survived impeachment. He'd been engaged in things that would normally land, you know, you and me in jail. We would be indicted at least. And he skated through that. So that made him feel like he was the best, you know, political strategist. He was the best arbiter of how to move forward on a policy. The combination was genuinely lethal. A person who had less guardrails around him and was convinced of his superiority in all decision making. And it meant he shut out a lot of smart people and shut out people like Robert Redfield, who believed that thousands of people died because he couldn't get Donald Trump to wear a mask. He shut out Bill Barr, who we all thought was, you know, sort of a henchman essentially to get Trump reelected by hook or by crook, and was actually trying to get him to recognize that you can't attack civil rights protesters in American cities.
In other words, like, I don't have that big of a hook to get him reelected. I mean, do you have a sense when you mentioned Redfield with his lamentation about the mask? Do you have a sense of like what went on with things like the PPE, the inability to sort of like, you know, all the weird contracts that were issued. And the idea of like, we're going to slow the roll on any type of national testing. I mean, my understanding is that like at one point they were going to send out masks through the post office and, that there was going to be more of like a national testing regime. Like who was that Donald Trump's idea? And people just sort of said, okay, where did that all come from?
So my understanding about this period is a little more, complicated because remember, at first, Donald Trump is trying to deny there is any problem. And that stretches pretty far from, you know, the first case being found in the third week of January in the United States until the second week of March. He's still in kind of a, oh, don't worry about this. During that time, but there's another factor that's not helping the United States' response. And that is that the CDC's testing plan, remember, they don't do national testing. They create a model for national testing. Their model doesn't work so great. There was nothing unusual about the fact that the CDC launched into creating sort of the banner example for all the other labs to use. It's just that it was fraught with peril because of earlier mistakes in the beginning of formulating the testing. The CDC doesn't do national testing. Labs, hospitals, they mimic the CDC's tests and they launch. But then there was a third thing that was making for big problems. And that was Donald Trump, in every opportunity, tried to reduce the chance of Americans learning how many people were infected. So, for example, when his chief of staff, and then at that time Mick Mulvaney, before he fired him, and at that time his deputy secretary of state and his health and human services secretary, Azar, they come to him and say, you know, Mr. President, Wuhan has been shuttered by the Chinese government. There is basically a gate around this province because of the outbreak of this mysterious pneumonia, and we have got to get American diplomats out of the city, out of the province, and back to America. The president initially says, absolutely not. That's just going to raise our numbers. If any of those people are sick, that's going to count towards a higher number of people with the virus. Now, keep in mind, these are diplomats who are in China to serve the U.S. public, to serve the U.S. government. And Trump's reaction is, well, I don't know why they're in China, but they shouldn't have gone there in the first place. So again, every chance he has, he wants to block the realization or the compilation of real data on how many Americans have this infection.
Who would you say, as you look over the course of, you know, and maybe there's two different answers, you know, depending on the era, who is the biggest enabler of Trump?
You know, sadly, it is his, I didn't even have to think about it. It's his chief of staff, Mark Meadows, who is extremely loyal to Donald Trump and described by most of those around him, including people who really liked and valued him, as a person who couldn't say no to Donald Trump, always wanted to encourage him, enable him, praise him. And so there was this incredibly awkward division and doublespeak in the White House, where a person would come, a senior advisor or a cabinet member would come to Meadows and say, you know, this idea of the president is really dangerous and you cannot let this happen. And Meadows would tell them, yes, yes, I'm working on it. But when speaking with Donald Trump, he said, oh, yes, I understand, Mr. President. You're so right. You're so right, Mr. President. It kind of reminds me a little bit of the tapes, the Nixon tapes, where you hear Kissinger telling President Nixon that his speech that night was the best that has ever been given by any American president. You know, oh, Mr. President, the best thing in the world.
Interesting. And who comes in second? I'm curious as to like the family. Where were they on the in this?
You know, it's funny because what we learned in our reporting for I Alone Can Fix It is that, you know, Ivanka Trump and Jared Kushner were often sort of working behind the scenes. Jared more than Ivanka, especially on COVID and on the election, re-election effort. And they were making strides and almost tuning the president out to a certain degree. And when they became concerned that the president's strategy wasn't that great, they weren't exactly forceful in calling that out with him. It wasn't that they feared him. It's that they just didn't have huge confrontations with him, even when they worried that that path was a perilous one for the country, for public health, or a waste of time.
Interesting. Well, it is an impressive second follow-up. Like I say, I just can't believe, you know, it's just, it just speaks volumes just that he was like, welcome back. You got my quote right. I'm a real stable genius. You guys, I just find that amazing. But Carol Lenig, the Washington Post author, co-author, I should say, with Philip Rucker, with I Alone Can Fix It, Donald J. Trump's Catastrophic Final Year. We'll put a link to that at majority.fm. Thanks so much for your time today.
I really enjoyed the conversation. Thanks so much, Sam and Emma.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. All right, folks, going to take a quick break. We'll come back to wrap it up. All right, folks, that's it for us today. If you're watching us on the Peacock app, a choice from MSNBC on the Peacock app, as we call it around here.
That's where we're at.
We will be back tomorrow and hope to see you then. But for those of you who are sticking around for the second half of the show program, we will be back momentarily. I mean, not even momentarily.
We'll be here.
We're just here. That's it. I was just saying that I was, you know, I didn't want to get into my Bill Barr rant about, and there's, I don't know. There is always, I'm a little jaded. You know, mm-hmm. History is always written from a perspective. And in this instance, it was written via these reporters from people's whose perspective it is like, I don't necessarily want to go down with the good ship Donald Trump. Which is not a reflection on my sense as to whether or not Lenig or Rucker are good reporters. I have no doubt that they backed up with other people.
Right.
You know, all these people are involved in, you know, we're a little bit close to the toxic generator. I mean, and so they're all sort of implicated.
But if you're writing this sort of book, like, within the confines of the story, there are going to be people portrayed or, you know, within a very small framework, there are people who are better than the other people. Right, but in the large scope of politics, they're all culpable.
Yeah,
because you're telling a story.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. Just a reminder: your support makes this show possible. You can become a member at jointhemajorityreport.com. Also, justcoffee.coop.
Oh, I just ordered a bunch more cold brew from them.
Yeah, I've been meaning to get the cold brew.
I get coarse ground.
I immediately always go with like the... Oh, you get them, you have them grinded.
Well, yeah, I don't... I have, you know, a little Nutribullet at my apartment, but what are you doing?
I was going to hit the... shoot. I gotta sort of like... I was going to hit my... Yeah. Can't get away with, you know, not grinding your own coffee.
Why not?
Just because. JustCoffee.coop, fair trade coffee, tea, or chocolate. Use the coupon code MAJORITY. Get 10% off. You can get the cold brew. And you can even have them grind it if that's what you're into.
I'll get a grinder. I have a different kind of grinder, but I'll get a grinder.
Whoa, this is really appropriate. Actually,
it's legal.
Yeah, it's legal now. Folks, also, don't forget the AM Quickie, the newsletter. We got a bunch of emails saying how much they enjoyed it. And you can sign up for it. It's completely free. Scroll down to the bottom of majority.fm. Sign up for that, baby, and then bingo bango. Also, don't forget tonight, youtube.com/TheNoMcKeeShow. youtube.com/TheNoMcKeeShow. Matt!
Left Reckoning, 8 o'clock Eastern tonight. Go subscribe to the YouTube.
Wait. It's tonight?
It's tonight. We're Wednesdays now.
You guys, I can't even follow when all you guys are moving your times around.
We're permanently Wednesdays. We will be joined by Daniel Bessner and Derek Davison of the American Prestige.
They were great.
So if you enjoyed them last week, we'll get another dose of them. We'll be talking, among other things, about Lula and Bolsonaro and probably Mike Lindell and Bannon talking about how he's not going to be allowed to win. Lula's not going to be allowed to win that election. Unless the computers steal it for him.
Do we have that clip,
yeah,
by the
we
way?
Do.
Okay.
And I'll also probably touch on Yang saying that crypto is a way to UBI and how I would feel about that if I was a UBI activist. And this idiot was coming around saying we should Bitcoin our way to it. So that's tonight, 8 Eastern. Go subscribe to the YouTube where we're fast approaching 15,000 subscribers. So check that out.
Wow.
Left Reckoning YouTube tonight.
Oh! All right, folks. See you in the fun half, 646-257-3920.
You are in for it.
All right, folks. 646-257-3920. See you in the fun.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
Are you ready?
Oh, no. Who sent us this?
Alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, back.
Just as delicious as you could imagine.
The alpha males are back, 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 boy is back, and the alpha males are back, 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 back.
Just wanna degrade the white man.
Alpha males are back, back.
I take all of it to my throat.
Alpha males are back, back, back.
Snowflake says what?
The alpha males are back, 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 back.
You are a madman!
And the alpha males are back, back.
Oh no, Sam Cedar, what a, whoa, what a fucking nightmare.
Can you bring back DJ Denner?
Yeah, or a couple of them, just put them in rotation.
DJ Denner.
Well, the problem with those is they're like 45 seconds long, so I don't know if they're enough for the break.
That's fucking nonsense.
See white people doing drugs that look worse than normal white people, and all white people look disgusting.
And the alpha males,
psych, fuck them, fuck them.
Snowflake says what?
What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What? What?
Snowflake says what?
A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank, okay. I'm making stupid money. Hell of a lot of bank. A hell of a lot of bank.
All lives matter.
Have you tried doing an impression on a college campus?
I think that there's no reason why reasonable people across the divide can't all agree with this. Psych.
And the alpha males are back, 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 back. And the Africans are black, 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 black African. And the alpha males are black, 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 black. And the Africans are back, 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 back.
When you see Donald Trump out there, doesn't a little part of you think that America deserves to be taken over by jihadists? Keep it at 100. Can't knock the hustle. Come on! Fuck them. Fuck them.
Things I do for the bigger game plan.
By the way, it's my birthday.
My birthday.
Happy birthday to me, Jew boy.
I have a thought experiment for you.
And the alpha males are back, back. Africans are black, black. Alpha males are black, black. Africans are back, back.
Come on. Come on. Come on. Someone needs to pay the price for blasphemy around here.
I am a total, 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 total,